Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.
What's going on right now? I'm talking with someone who you probably know all about his music. You might not know his name. You probably do. He's done a lot of press lately because they're celebrating 40 years this year. It is Brian Slagel, the owner and founder of the illustrious Metal Blade Records. There's so many CDs behind me that have the trademark of Metal Blade Records. So welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So my first question, you're a hockey nut. What's it going to take to get you up to Seattle Climate Pledge Arena for a Kraken game?
Soon, very soon. It's on my list to do almost as soon as possible because, they're going to be good, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to be good this year, but they're drafting some really, really good players. Bernier and Wright, 1-2 centers. I mean, that couple of years, that's gonna be scary, but yeah, I'm dying to get up there. The arena looks amazing, and
that's awesome.
I gotta check it off my list.
I'm going to see Iron Maiden there tonight with Trivium, so it'll be great.
I was supposed to go to that, but a whole bunch of other stuff happened, so I'm not there.
You're a busy man. Your hockey jersey collection is something I've spied a bit on your social media, or I can't remember where I saw it, but you have a crazy hockey jersey collection. I'm a band shirt guy, so I have a ridiculous hoarding situation in my closet. What's your hockey jersey count? Do you have a count?
Yeah, I've got about 2,500 jerseys.
Jesus, that's awesome.
800 of them are game worn. I think I might have more metal shirts than that, though. I've never really counted those.
Yeah. I'm doing a thing right now on Twitter where I just was like, you know, I'm going to wear a band t-shirt every day until I run out and see how many I can get up to. I'm at like 148 right now, so.
Yeah, I think I might take years for that potentially.
And then at the end, you just have an insane like laundry day.
Right. Yeah, right. Laundry month.
Laundry. Yeah, exactly. You got to pay for the mass laundry on that one. So, Matt, congratulations on 40 years of Metal Blade.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was looking back at your catalog. I actually interviewed someone recently from the band Bitter End. They put out a record on Metal Blade years ago. So I wanted to kind of tie that back to the Seattle connection, you know, Panic. You know, we had Panic back in the day. We had, we had Bitter End. You know, what was your tie to like the Seattle metal scene back in the day? Were these bands that were on your radar? How did you hear about, you know, the Seattle metal scene and whatnot?
Well, yeah, it all really goes back to Metal Church in the very early days. We were going to sign Metal Church, actually, to Metal Blade initially, but this is, you know, way back in the days before the internet or anything. So, you know, they ended up signing with a local Seattle label because it explained to people that, you know, back in the day, it just made sense for bands to sign with a local label because long distance phone calls were insanely expensive. So trying to communicate with a band was just impossible. So bands from New York signed with, you know, Mega Force, and bands from LA sign with us, and that sort of thing. So, I've been a big fan of the Seattle scene for a long time. I was up there actually quite a few times to see Mother Love Bone when they were playing with, we had a relationship with Capitol Records at the time, and I went up there with their A&R person when everybody's trying to sign them. And of course, I saw them, I don't know, two or three times, and they were phenomenal. And I was in very early with Alice in Chains because my friend, the A&R guy, signed them. He actually sent me their demo, said, "I'm signing this band. What do you think?" And I said, "I think they're amazing."
Yeah.
So I've been going up there for quite a while and have a lot of contacts up there. And usually that's what happens when we sign bands is somebody in a city will say, hey, there's this really cool band, check out the demo. And then you hear it, it's really good. And then you see them. I remember Panic. That's a band that had so much potential. I mean, yeah. I went up there and saw them a couple times and they were amazing live too.
Yeah. Dude from Panic is in Sanctuary now. So Sanctuary is going to be putting out another record.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's awesome.
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. So you mentioned kind of like back in the day you had a relationship with Capitol Records. But one thing that I wanted to mention is that Metal Blade Records is one of the last like real independent labels. Like you guys are independent. You guys are a big, it's not, you know, like a basement operation. You guys are a global force with, you know, bands like Cannibal Corpse, like a band like Amon Amarth. What's it mean to you to be independent?
Well, I mean, it's extremely important to me because the first and foremost, everything is about the music and the bands. And obviously, you know, all of my friends who own other labels, both metal and not metal, and sold their labels. I mean, almost immediately their reaction was, that's the worst thing I ever did. Because you go from, you know, creating something on your own and building it to, you know, selling it to somebody else. And then you have to answer to them if you want to do anything. And losing that freedom for me would be just terrible. I want to wake up in the morning and do, if I want to do something, I want to do it. I don't have to ask somebody to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm not motivated by money. I've had an amazing career and I've got enough money. I'm fine. I'm not motivated at all by that. I'm more motivated by providing a home, an independent free home for, you know, our artists to be able to do things without, you know, being kind of stuck in the corporate machine. So, I mean, really it's kind of us and Epitaph, the kind of last two, you know, big independents that are fully independent.
That's great, man. Before we get more into the history of Metal Blade, I was curious about your history of Metal Shop. Do you remember ever listening to Metal Shop when it was a syndicated show with Charlie Kendall?
Absolutely. In fact, I have audio tapes and vinyl tapes of those in my archive somewhere.
Oh man, I got to hear those. That's amazing. That's awesome. You know, Metal Shop, the only show with teeth.
Yes.
Yes. So
legendary. Absolutely.
Absolutely, man. And I was just curious about that. So back in the day, you know, it comes down to like you must have been just a metal nerd like all of us, right? Just a metalhead. Just, you know, what was the spark? You know, I'm sure you've told this story many times, but let's get it on record again. What was the spark, man? Were you a big, you know, Zeppelin fan? What was the spark to start your label?
No one Led Zeppelin.
Okay.
When I grew up, the first heavy metal album I heard was a cousin of mine played me Machine Head by Deep Purple, and that changed my life right there.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this? And then about a week later, my neighbor said, hey, if you like Deep Purple, you should listen to Black Sabbath. And so that began me, you know, going down the hole there, the heavy metal hole. But you know, when we fast forward to the new wave of British heavy metal, I had heard Iron Maiden I was a big cassette tape trader back in the day, and a guy from Sweden that I was trading tapes with sent me the Iron Maiden demo, and I was like, wow, what is this? This is amazing. And then the first album came out, and I got completely immersed in the new wave of British heavy metal, which of course, if you don't know, was a scene in the late 70s, early 80s in England that spawned Iron Maiden, Saxon, Def Leppard, on and on. And I became obsessed with the whole thing. You know, I was living in LA, so it wasn't a lot you could really do about it. But I got really into that, and that really inspired me a lot. And I ended up starting the first ever US heavy metal fanzine called the New Heavy Metal Review, REVUE. I don't know why, but that's what they called it.
Yeah.
Then I started working at a record store. I started programming the local radio station that had their metal show. I was really at the record store that, you know, I didn't realize that there was anything happening in LA. I was just importing all the, you know, all the European stuff, you know, Marshall Fate and Accept and all the new wave of British heavy metal stuff. And one day, one of the guys that would come in and buy a lot of stuff from me said, hey, you know, there's metal bands in LA. And I said, there are? And I said, yeah. So the first show I saw was Motley Crue and Rat for $1 on a Wednesday at the Troubadour. I was like, oh, wow. There really are good bands here in LA. And there was a scene actually happening unbeknownst to really anybody, because again, you're talking, you know, 1981 and 82 when there was no internet, no nothing. So it kind of lived in this vacuum. And it was frustrating to me because nobody knew it existed outside of LA, but no labels were going to touch any of these bands. So I just got the idea based on the independent attitude of the new wave of British heavy metal, because they would put out these compilation albums. I thought, well, maybe if I put out a compilation album of LA heavy metal bands, you know, some people would buy it. I talked to the distributors that I was buying the imports from, and they said, sure. And I put together the record, and that was the first Metal Massacre. And it kind of, I was just a metal nerd trying to help. I couldn't play an instrument, so I figured, well, I got to try to do something else. So that's kind of where it started.
Man, I have such parallels to like that story. You know, I worked at a record store. I started a punk hardcore metal fanzine when I was a kid, not a kid, more so just like 15 years ago, but seems like a kid. But, you know, like all these things. And it's like, man, that what a cool trajectory, you know, like just starting as DIY, just doing it yourself. And then, you know, fast forward 40 years and, you know, you have the biggest label in metal. So, man, that when you look back at that time, you know, like what was the initial goal of Metal Blade? You know, was it just to put out your friend's band?
There's no goals at all.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time, really, because there were so many great bands that were happening in LA. And then, you know, the other famous story is this kid named Lars Ulrich moved from Denmark to LA. And my friend ran into him in the parking lot of a Michael Schenker show. And, you know, we all started hanging out together. And, he came because he was also, of course, obsessed with that same scene. And as were my friend John Cornerens and I. And I think he came to L.A. not expecting to know anybody that would know anything about the scene. And, you know, a week in, he's all of a sudden hanging out with these guys that have the same interest that he did. And, of course, you know, he went on to put together a band that ended up on that first Metal Massacre record that did okay. But there was never really a goal or anything. I had no money. I was able to scrape together enough money to put out the first pressing of it that I had no money, and I made every mistake possible on it. But one of the distributors named Greenworld said, you know, we know you don't have any money, but you seem like you might have something going on here. So we'll give you a pressing and distribution deal. So if you can bring us bands, then, you know, we can put them out and actually, you know, pay for the manufacturing. So I still didn't have any money, but I went to the bands and said, hey, if you can record something, we can actually put it out. So, you know, early stuff was like Armored Saint and Bitch and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah. And Slayer came on a little bit later. And, you know, it just kind of grew from there. But there was no mission. There was no, you know, goal. I was just a young kid kind of flying by the seat of my pants, just seeing where this thing was going to go. It was going to go anywhere.
When was the, like, holy shit moment? Like, was it Slayer? Was it the release of Slayer? Was it, I mean, you know, you got the Metal Massacre out there, and I'm sure it did pretty well.
I don't know there was a singular moment, really, because it was a long period of time where I was working, you know, in the back of my mom's house in a room with no air conditioning, which in Woodland Hills, where it's 106, was a lot of fun in the summer, but I didn't care. So I was just you kind of heads down, just, you know, blinders on, just doing this every day. And I was doing everything at the time, a one man show. So, but I do think that the time where it seemed to change more dramatically was when Hell Awaits came out. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when Show No Mercy came out, that was really good. And honestly, when Armored Saint got signed to Chrysalis, that was big for us because, you know, they gave us the first little bit of mainstream coverage and all the magazines and stuff. But really when Hell Awaits came out, you know, even making that record, I felt there's something really special here. You know, we had done Show No Mercy and we had done the Haunting the Chapel EP and the live EP, and they were clearly building to something. But that record was kind of like, I think this is going to be really big. And that was kind of the record that really more or less started really put us on the map, I guess.
Yeah. I'm, you know, visually Metal Blade has had like these different eras, right? So I have a Harm's Way hoodie that has the blade, you know, and then we got, I remember Twitching Tongues, they put out, they kind of brought back the axe for a little while. And then you guys started to really bring the axe back. And then there's the pirate kind of theme and the skull. So like, as far as like branding and imaging, what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, we've gone through, you know, basically four logos. We had the Bloody Axe logo, which was the very first one, which was probably my favorite. It's very remedial, but it looks pretty cool. And then we had like just a very simple, you know, logo. And then we had our, we called our corporate logo, which actually the Killswitch guys put on their last record. So I went, oh, that logo. Okay. And then the pirate logo. And the pirate logo is probably the one that's most recognized. You know, we're doing a lot of branding now where we have a whiskey. Yep. I'm sorry. We have a vodka. We have a rum. We have a beer. We have coffee. We have candles, all these things. And that's all based around at the moment, the pirate logo, but we're doing some 40th anniversary stuff. That's got the Bloody Axe on it too. So, but we let the bands decide which logo they want to have on their records. So that's, we go, cool. Okay, whatever logo you want, you can have, because a lot of bands started requesting the Bloody Axe, which we hadn't used for a long time. And, you know, the staff came and said, can they use this? I don't care. They can use whatever logo they want.
Yeah.
We own all of them. It's all of ours. So it's kind of fun. And we've got merch for all the different logos now too and stuff. So it's been kind of fun. And it's, you know, it's branding and album covers and logos and these things to me are very important, because, you know, as a kid, you know, when I first saw, you know, the first Iron Maiden record, it's like, wow, that cover's really cool. That logo is awesome. And then when Killers came out, I went, oh my, this is like the greatest album cover ever. And so I've always been a big fan of the imaging and the logos. I mean, going back to, you know, I was a big fan of Kiss and Alice Cooper and, you know, all that sort of stuff where there's a lot of image going on.
Oh man. So when I say like, actually, I'll leave that question in just a moment. So you were mentioning 40, you know, doing a lot of things, like you've got the alcohol, you got the beer, you got, you know, candles. But one thing that you did, and you opened up a museum in Las Vegas, the Metal Blade Museum. So tell me a little bit about that. Do you live in Las Vegas?
I live in Las Vegas. I moved out here about 6 years ago. Okay. Absolutely love it. It's a lot different than people would think living here, but it's so like a small town vibe here. Everybody here is so really great and so nice, and everybody's helpful for whatever you need. I've made a ton of really good friends out here, which, you know, grew up and lived in LA for my whole life, and I've spent a lot of time in New York, all over the place. But I loved all those places as well, and I have friends that in all of them. But it just this seems like a cool, just an overall cool vibe out here. It's just so easy to make friends, and you get connections everywhere and stuff. So anyway, I moved out here, and considering that the public storage situation out here is way cheaper than it is in LA, I said, well, why don't we move all our storage stuff from LA to Vegas? Cause it'll cost us like a third of the money. Yeah. So while we're doing that, I'm like looking at all this stuff. And I was like, it's kind of a shame that all these things are just sitting in a warehouse, you know, 40 years of all the stuff we've done. So I got the idea of actually buying a house in Vegas and just making that a museum. So I did that. And then all of a sudden people, I didn't really intend it to be anything other than just a cool, fun thing for friends and different people to come over. But, you know, I had guys like Charlie Benante come over and Joey Veer and people, and they say, hey, can we take photos of these and post them on the internet? I don't care. So I started posting.
Oh, this old stuff?
Everybody starts freaking out about it. Yeah. And, you know, where can we go see it? And I'm thinking, well, I don't really know that we can do that in a house. So kind of got the idea, well, let's see if we can find a spot here in Vegas and just make it there. And actually, weirdly, the timing was really great for me, because when the whole COVID thing hit and when everything was like really shut down for that 4 months or however long it was, I went in every day and just worked on the museum. So it gave me something to do for 4 months, where I probably would have done out of my mind if I didn't have anything to do. So it's ready now. We're kind of doing it where we're just picking our spots and selling some tickets. I'm doing like a really fun tour of it. And we've done a bunch so far. They've been super, super fun to do. So that's kind of where the model is at this point, as we're coming out of everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's still early in its existence, I guess. And, you know, we're talking to other museums here, because in Vegas, we've got the Kiss Museum, which is amazing.
Yeah.
There's Zach Bagans Haunted Museum, which is really cool. And
Museum.
Yeah, the Mob Museum. That guy. There's a whole bunch of stuff. There's a Hollywood Car Museum.
Yeah.
They're building a punk rock museum here. There's also going to be a Grammy Museum. So there's a lot of music related stuff here. So we're kind of all talking together about doing stuff. But it just was kind of a fun project to do, and it's just nice to be able to show off that stuff to fans and not just have it sit in a warehouse.
The metal nerdery of me, like, dude, I just, that would be amazing. I got to come down sometime and check out that. That sounds amazing. Wow.
Please.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. I was curious about, so what was the first band t-shirt you ever purchased? when you were a kid?
Wow, that's a really good question. I don't even know if I have an answer for that. It would either have been Deep Purple or Black Sabbath.
Okay.
I don't remember which. It probably was one of the two. But I didn't really have a whole lot of money growing up, so
yeah.
I was more about buying records at that point. Like any penny I had went to buying records. So I don't think I really bought. I'm trying to remember now, because I think I finally remembered. So my first ever show was Kiss in LA in 1976.
Yeah,
I'm old. And I'm pretty sure that was the first time I bought a shirt was there. Because I don't remember before that really buying a t-shirt of anything before that. Like I said, I was all about music. So that was probably the first one.
Do you have all of the records that you grew up buying and stuff? Is that still your collection?
I have all my records. I have actually, shamefully, I have an entire house here in Vegas that houses all of my music memorabilia. I kept all my old cassettes. I kept all my vinyl. I kept all that stuff. I'm a bit of not really a hoarder or anything, but I like to keep that sort of stuff. The only thing I didn't keep that I absolutely regret now is I was moving once and I had all, I bought a ton of t-shirts, in the late 70s. So I had all the concert t-shirts from all the 70s, the 80s. And they're all in I had a bunch of them. I had a bunch of old ones stored in these trash bags and I just gave them away. And then, a few years later, I'm looking at these Iron Maiden shirts, whatever, from there. They're selling for $500.
Yep, yep. The vintage market now is crazy,
Yeah, because idiots like me gave them all away. So there you go.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show. We bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.
Man, those people that got those were like, "Oh right, yes, score." I interviewed a guitarist from Municipal Waste, Ryan Waste, a couple weeks back, and I asked him this question, and it kind of made me think like I need to ask this question more. So, record collectors, music nerds, what is your prized LP or a couple of them? Is there a couple LPs that you're just like, they could all go away, but this is it?
There's a couple of them. I mean, more for the rarities of it, I think. I mean, I love all that new British heavy metal stuff. So there's a band called Mithra that put out just an EP. And I think they ended up putting out an album. But that EP was one of my favorites of all time. And it's really hard to find. I also have almost every of the 45, the singles that came out in that new British heavy metal time too. So I have... It's like a really rare Urchin single, which is Adrian Smith's first band from Iron Maiden. I think there was 25 of these things made.
Wow.
So I have that. But in terms of albums, probably the rarest thing I have is we were working with Motley Crue when they were at the fanzine and the record store when they were starting. And I knew their management. They would take out ads in the fanzine. And I did a lot of work for Motley Crue in the early days. So these two managers came to my mom's house and said, hey, we have 900 Motley Crue records. What do we do with them? I'm, 20-year-old kid. I go, take them to Green World. They'll sell them for you.
Yeah.
It's like if I would have known then what I knew now. But I've got four of those things. There's only 900 of them. It's a black and white logo. Somebody told me they're going for some insane amount of money now. So, that's pretty rare. I've got a lot of test pressings.
I'd imagine.
The early Bell Awaits and Show No Mercy test pressings are pretty cool. So there's a lot of stuff in there.
That's crazy. I mean, you could have a second museum just on your own personal. That's amazing,
right.
Dude. The,
right.
And you're not a hoarder. You're a collector of cool. It's a total difference, man.
Yeah, I agree. And they're all neatly. It's all kind of put together. Again, the only good thing about the whole COVID thing was I was able to put together the museum, and actually the music house is where the museum used to be. So I kind of transitioned it to my thing, but at least it kept me busy.
So is that what kind of one of my questions I was going to ask is what kind of kept you sane and kept you busy during COVID? And it sounds like you were busy with just kind of creating and doing that.
Yeah, I mean that was a large portion of it. The other thing that I did that I ripped off from a bunch of people who were doing it, but I would do these either Facebook live things or I was doing them, I think, on Instagram. The Instagram things were fun. So what I would do is, I had to see all my friends because you couldn't see anybody. So I had all my friends on. I had Amon Johan from Amon Amarth, you know, Chris Jericho, just, you know, Adam D from Killswitch, just all my friends, and say, hey, let's do like an hour long, like just like we're doing here, an hour long live thing on the internet, just so we can at least say hi and catch up and let people in. And I was doing a Facebook thing where just, you know, have, you know, just have fans and people just ask questions and stuff. So that was really fun. And we were able to be connected to other people, because that's that was the tough thing. You couldn't, you know, you were supposed to leave your house or anything. So so between the museum and the my music house and doing that sort of stuff, that kept me pretty sane through the whole thing. And then I'm a massive sports fan. So, you know, like when the UFC, they were the first like pro sports thing to come back live. So I watched a lot of that, and I had a couple friends of mine, like every Saturday we'd come and we just go on YouTube and do deep dives of, you know, let's watch, you know, all the old Black Sabbath footage or whatever it was.
That's cool.
So it wasn't really too bad on my end, thankfully.
So, you know, personally, it sounds like you got through sane, but like, you know, pandemic hits, you guys are a small business, as big as you are, you're still not a small business, but you're an independent business. Right. So, you know, what was that like, as far as just like, did you guys have like an all hands meeting? Like, okay, you know, we're going to pause, or like, you know, it seems like you guys weathered it pretty well.
Well, there was when everything was shut down, it was a little scary because we didn't really know, you know, what was going on, and nobody could work and nobody could really do anything. But once, you know, things started to ease a little bit, you know, we decided, because we couldn't really put out any new records because bands couldn't record or anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're very lucky that we have a very large catalog. Yep. So the idea was, let's exploit the catalog as much as we can. Let's make as much vinyl as we can. Any sort of physical product, and let's see how that goes. And we're incredibly lucky that, I think really what happened is, because all of the fans couldn't go to concerts, you know, they had extra income. And I think that they're aware of the plight of a lot of these bands and how to support them. So the only really way to support them would be to buy either, you know, stream crazy a lot of product, or buy the physical product, and also buy the band's merch. So, you know, all of that stuff was happening. And for us, I kind of feel embarrassed saying it, but the two main COVID years were two of the best years we've ever had, because we sold so much product. And that's just a testament to how great heavy metal fans are. I mean, they supported it however they could. And certainly, you know, it helped us be able to give, you know, nice checks to the bands to keep them, you know, as afloat as they could be. So it was really weird, because it ended up being those 2 years were just incredible. And of course, again, it's to the greatness of all the fans out there for supporting, you know, what we were doing. So, but it was surprising at first, that's for sure.
Well, when you give a metalhead a $1,500 check in the mail, what do you think they're going to buy?
They're going to buy metal,
you know, like
times. I was also happy because we were able to keep our entire staff on the whole time.
Yes.
We didn't let anybody go.
Yeah.
We did get some help from the government, both in Europe and in the US, which was helpful. So,
yeah.
But that made me happy, because, you know, I know a lot of people didn't get to keep their gigs. Mm-hmm. So that was good. We survived all that.
And that, I mean, as an independent business, like, that's huge, you know, as an independent label, keeping your entire staff during that 2 years, that's something to be commended for, man. And that's really cool. So, you know, you guys got through that, and, you know, tours are happening. Do you get to hit a lot of shows when you're in Vegas, or are you more of a homebody?
No, I mean, look, before the pandemic, I would go to anything and everything. I think of my spots a little bit these days, although we're getting into a good spot. But the problem I have in Vegas is that not everybody plays here.
Mm.
And I'm trying to rectify that
situation. Yeah.
So a lot of times because I have a place in Dallas, because we do a lot of stuff in Dallas. King Diamond is there. So, and I love to go to shows in Dallas because the venues there are great. Mm-hmm. I'm friends with all the people that work in the venue, so it's super chill. And for me, like the bands, when they play in Dallas, there's nobody backstage. And usually there are trips for the next gig. They're in Austin or San Antonio or something. So it's pretty late bus call. So, you know, I could have a 3 hour hang with these guys, which you normally wouldn't never get. If I went to a show in LA or New York, it's like, hey, how you doing? And there's 4 million people there. And, you know, even in Vegas, it's always kind of crazy. So I try to go to as many as I can. It's getting insane now because we've got, you know, Amon Amarth is out, Merciful Fate is out, Cannibal Corpse is out. Revocation is out.
Yep. Going to see them next week. Yep.
Yep. So, you know, I'm planning to see all these shows. Killswitch is out. Yep. Luckily, they're playing in Vegas, so
yeah,
I can see them here. And you know, I got to travel to see Iron Maiden because they're not playing here for some reason on this tour, which didn't make me very happy. But it's all right. I'm gonna go see them in New York, hopefully. So yeah, I'm trying to go to as many shows as I can now.
Nice, man. Well, you know, I've gone to so many too. I just saw, you know, it's almost like a. It's like a embarrassment of riches with the touring. Right. It's just like, man, nothing for 2 years. And then all of a sudden, just boom. It's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah, we could see that. I knew that was coming. It was just, yep, you know, a matter of time. And I mean, look, most of the tours are doing well, but there are not all of them, unfortunately. But
sure. So, you know, looking at the entire like crazy catalog of Metal Blade Records, I am curious if there's something that you think is like underrated, something that like you could pinpoint and be like, I thought this was going to take off. This should have taken off. And it's a hidden gem. Is there anything like that?
I don't know if it's necessarily a hidden gem at this point because it's in the Decibel Hall of Fame and all these sort of things, but it was definitely the one record that I thought for sure was going to be huge. And that's Symbol Salvation by Armored Saint.
Okay.
And that's an important record to me because that, you know, I grew up with those guys. They were, you know, one of the first bands we ever signed, and they've remained really close friends of mine forever. In fact, Tracy Vera, who, you know, really pretty much runs Metal Blade, she does the heavy work, you know,
her husband
is Joey Vera, bass player. So they're all, you know, they're all family. And you know, they had kind of broken up after they'd signed to Chrysalis, and they, you know, they got dropped and they broke up. And then Dave Pritchard, the great guitar player, passed away from leukemia. So they were pretty much done. But they made all these amazing demos. I thought some of the best stuff they've ever done. And so I just kind of started to wear them down. I go, we got to put these out, you know, just for Dave's memory. So we were able to get it together. Dave Jordan, who did, you know, Alice in Chains and Chains Addiction, produced it. We got Q Prime involved to manage them. We kind of put this whole big team together and made what I thought was this phenomenal record.
Yeah.
And it came out and it did well, but I firmly believe that record came out in 1991, right? If it came out in 1989, I think it would have been huge. But by 91, that was, you know, the beginning of the Nirvanas and the Seattle.
Yeah. You have us to blame. Yeah.
That, you know, probably rightfully so killed metal at that point because it did need to reinvent itself. But that's one that kind of always bummed me out. But it's over the years, it's done pretty well. A lot of people know about it for sure. The only one other one I'll mention right now is that I've kind of been talking about this a lot lately, but there's a band from Canada that I've always loved, a thrash metal band from like, they started in the, you know, the thrash movement. It's called Sacrifice. Mm-hmm. They put out some amazing albums that it's just a crime that they're not in that, you know, top five thrash bands of all time. But
yeah,
their stuff is really good. If you like thrash metal, check out any Sacrifice record. It's so good.
I got their cassette tape. So, you know.
There you go.
Just one of them, though. I don't have the whole discography, but I do have one of their cassette tapes. So, you know, we were just, you know, celebrating the anniversary of Tomb of the Mutilated. I almost blanked there. Tomb of the Mutilated. And was that, thinking back to, you know, that time, was that the most extreme thing that Metal Blade had put out at that point? Like the most hardcore, like death metal, guttural, like thing to push the boundaries? Or was, am I kind of wrong on the timeline there?
Well, aside from the Mentors, which we put out in the 80s, which probably pushed the boundaries as much as you could.
The El Duce, yes.
But yeah, I mean, Cannibal Corpse, you know, we didn't really, you know, for whatever reason, you know, we were really late to the death metal party, you know, Relapse and Earache did a great job of, you know, signing a bunch of those bands and, you know, Roadrunner. I don't know, I just wasn't really into it that much. And then all of a sudden I get this cassette tape by this band Cannibal Corpse. And I looked at the Mike Failey, who works for us, who's from Buffalo, of course, that's from Buffalo. So he gave me the tape and I said, you should check this out. I looked at the song titles and I said, there's a song on here called A Skull Full of Maggots. I'm going to sign this band, whether this tape's terrible or not, just because of the song title. And of course it was good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I saw them, I was talking about this the other day too. I saw them in Phoenix, this old place called the Mason Jar, which sadly doesn't exist, but it was a tiny little club. But I saw them there for the first time when they toured for the second album. And I was like, oh my gosh, this band is incredible.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I, you know, I always like to push the boundaries. I mean, we've got Gwar, you know, we got a lot of bands that hover on the edge of that stuff. But I mean, look, if you just look at how many places they've been banned and everything, then yeah, Cannibal Corpse would for sure be the most controversial thing we'd probably put out.
Nice, man. Well, you know, I mean, at this point, they're like the Beatles of death metal. Like they're like, you just hear the people that don't even know death metal hear the name death Cannibal Corpse and they know what it's going to be. So
Ace Ventura helped that too. So
there you go. Absolutely. Shout out Jim Carrey. So like, okay, an upcoming band that's, you know, starting to make some noise. What's a piece of advice you would give them to like get on the radar of a Metal Blade or, you know, any real label? What's a piece of advice you would give to, you know, a young musician?
Well, is what I tell them all the time. First and foremost is write music for yourselves. Just for the however many people in the band, write music for yourselves. Don't write it for anybody else. Don't listen to anybody else. Don't listen to managers, lawyers, spouses, whatever. And also do something that's original. Like take your influences, whatever your influences are, and put them into something that's original that you guys like. Because, you know, we have Amon Amarth. I don't need to hear, you know, if we get demos for 100 bands selling Amon Amarth or you know, whoever it is. Take those influences, but do something different, because that's really what's going to set anybody apart. And if you look at every single metal band that's come along, for the most part, they're doing something different and they have their take on it. And that's the most important thing. Be original, try to do something fresh and different. It's not that not as everybody else is doing. And, you know, it might take you a lot longer to get up the tree, so to speak. But if you're doing something original and different, that's the main component to do it. Have fun and do it for yourselves and make the music for what you guys want and don't make it for anybody else or what you think anybody else wants to hear.
Nice. Good advice, man. Well, if you had some advice for 13-year-old Brian, what advice would you give 13-year-old Brian? Save those t-shirts. Don't give them away.
Yeah, right. Probably, I mean, the one, I made a lot of mistakes over the course of time, and you know, you learn from the mistakes. But I think the thing that almost killed the label was I was so attached to vinyl that when vinyl was ending, and everybody told me vinyl was ending, and I was just so stubborn and like, no, it's not. I'm going to keep making it.
Yeah.
And then we got it all returned one day and it, you know, almost put the company out of business. I had to fund the company for about 6 months on credit cards.
Wow.
So I think I would have, the 13-year-old self probably would have said, like, listen to what people are telling you, especially if they know what they're doing, which I eventually learned to do. But it took me that mistake to realize, oh yeah, I probably should have listened.
But then it comes a time where vinyl is, you know, the best selling thing and you get your revenge, right?
Well, the silver lining, right, was that I could not bear to destroy all the vinyl because everybody else was destroying all the vinyl and I could not bear it. So we had a big warehouse in Phoenix, Arizona, and, you know, people would come in and we have this gigantic wall of vinyl. People were like, why are you keeping all this vinyl? I go, I just can't get rid of it. Maybe someday, but I can't do it. Of course, as time went on, the vinyl became big again and we ended up getting rid of all of that. And now we can't keep vinyl in stock, which is, I mean, it's an amazing thing for somebody that loves vinyl, but it is kind of mind blowing that, you know, 40 years later, it's selling as much as it is.
That is one thing about, you know, metalhead specifically. There are a lot of people that buy vinyl and, you know, still buy physical media in other genres and whatnot, but in metal specifically, like metalheads will buy the product. I still buy CDs, you know, people will call it an outdated form of media, but I love listening to a CD in my car. I find that my music ADD turns off a little bit. If I slip a CD in, I pay more attention to it. So
yeah, same here. I mean, I still buy vinyl all the time. I have my old record player and I have my CD player all set up. Yep. So yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. It's really kind of metal and country. It's two genres where physical product still is a big thing. So, you know, I hope it stays that way because I do like the look and the feel of everything, and especially vinyl, the artwork and the inner. But even with CDs, you still have the artwork and you have all the liner notes and things. Yep. It's tough to listen to a record. Yeah, look, I love the streaming stuff too, and it makes it easy. I put it on the background or whatever. But there's something about sitting down to listen to an album.
Mm-hmm.
Also interesting these days. I just have the experience of, you know, reading the lyrics and the liner notes and all that sort of stuff. It's obviously I grew up doing that, so it's something that's important to me, but I love seeing, you know, all these newer generations doing the same thing.
That's awesome, man. So let's, you know, keep buying music from bands that you love, keep supporting independent labels. And that's what the, you know, the metal community does, and the heavy music community. And like you said, the country music community too. So, so just winding down a couple more questions for you, man. Last couple of years, you know, were crazy. I'm sure you had some, you know, pretty stressful days. If you're having a day, what's an album you can put on that will bring you back to a good place? Whether it's a calming album, a gnarly album to get your aggression out, just something you can put on if you're having a day, like a standby.
Oh, there's a lot of them. Obviously, being a fanatical music fan that I am, you know, I'm going to go in kind of a weird, not really weird direction, but you know, one of my all-time favorite bands is Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
And an album called Fire of Unknown Origin, which came out in like 1981, I think, produced by Martin Birch, who's the greatest producer of all time. He produced almost all of my favorite albums, you know, all the Rainbow stuff, the Maiden stuff, the Purple, on and on and on. But I just love that record. It came out at a time when I was working at the record store. And, you know, for a while, the owner was letting me play a lot of heavy stuff, but he had a pretty large clientele. So one day he came in and said, during the day, you gotta mellow out. So, you know, I would, you know, play other stuff, but I could play this album because it was heavy, but it wasn't over the top heavy. But I always just love that record. It always puts me in a really good mood. So if I'm having a bad day or anything, I'll grab that record and put it on and just check it out. And I'm always soothed by that. And it brings me to a happy place. Because I mean, I love working at the record stores, you know, just a great job to have, you know, turning people on to music. And it was super fun.
That some of those albums you mentioned, you know, I'm just, you know, kind of coming off the high of watching the Dreamers Never Die last night, the new Dio documentary. And, you know, some of those albums, you know, you mentioned were Dio. Do you have any memories of like seeing Dio or meeting Dio?
Oh, yes. I'm a bunch. First of all, one of the nicest people ever. I haven't seen the doc yet, but I know a lot of people have. I feel bad because they invited me to the South by Southwest thing and I couldn't go. And they invited me to the premiere in LA last week and I couldn't go because, unfortunately, my job is insane at the moment.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, one of the nicest people ever. And I was really lucky enough to meet him on many occasions. We actually, the Knock Up the Wolves record, we were at Warner Bros. At the time, and we did all the marketing promotion for that.
Yeah.
And I really love that record. It didn't do what it should have done. But again, it was 1991 and all of that. But I still have a real special place for that record. It was really great working with him and Wendy. And, you know, Wendy is fantastic as well.
Yeah.
But probably my funniest story with Ronnie. Well, I have two funny stories with Ronnie to tell real quick. So the first one was we were flying to to Japan for Loud Park, and as it was like, I was sitting next to the Napalm Death guys, and as like Dying guys were on, all these people were on the plane, and Ronnie somehow somebody made a mistake, and they put Ronnie in coach.
Uh-oh.
So we're kind of like, oh wow, but he didn't really complain or anything, it was fine, but he was sitting next to the As I Dying guys and they're freaking out because they're fans, freaking out. So, and Ronnie's like a super nice guy, so I went over and Mike Failey, who works with us again, went over. We know Ronnie. So we talked to Ronnie and introduced him to the other guys and stuff. So they had a little conversation on the flight, which was great, and Ronnie was always really nice.
Yeah.
So they were they were backstage at the Loud Park thing, and they ran into Ronnie, and they, you know, he was nice and friendly, and they said, "Hey, how do you tell us how to properly do the sign?" You know, the sign. So he got like down on his legs and just, you know, did this whole like thing of how to, showed him how to do it. It was pretty hysterical.
That's awesome.
Nice. But my favorite moment with Ronnie was when Iron Maiden, I think it was 2008, and Iron Maiden was playing the Forum in LA, and Ronnie was there.
Yeah.
So I was backstage and we're talking to him. I think Lars was with me. Actually, Kerry King was there too. But anyway, we're talking to Ronnie and I said, we're talking about Maiden because I think they were doing I can't remember if that was the tour they're doing the Egyptian stuff again. But anyway, I told Ronnie, I said, one of the greatest 10 days of my life was in London in 1984, where I saw Dio twice with Queensryche opening.
Yeah.
On the Egyptian tour. And then I saw Maiden that same week, three times, all at Hammersmith Odeon, which is like this legendary, amazing thing.
Yeah.
But it's funny because Ronnie's tour was all Egypt themed. Okay. And that was the Maiden tour that was all Egypt themed.
That's awesome.
So I asked him, I said, were you aware that literally you guys had the same theme going on, and the backdrops and everything were pretty similar. And he said, I never really knew about that, but he said, but he hated Hammersmith Odeon. He hated it. He said, I hate that place. Because apparently it was built a long time ago. There's no elevators. So everything has to be brought up, the stairs, all the equipment, everything. He said it was just a nightmare. So I mean, I love the playing the shows there, but I hated every other aspect of it. I was like, don't tell me that.
Right.
You're ruining
my memory, man.
Yeah, but it was pretty funny. But yeah, he said he had no idea that they were both doing the same, basically the same tour theme at the time. I said, yeah, I saw both of you guys that week. I was like, did Ronnie leave his setup for Ronnie?
Right? Could have practically combined tours, man. That would be epic.
But all those shows were, you know, mind blowing. Just yeah. Amazing.
Man, dude, so many cool memories and so many cool, you know, things that you're making memories. 40 years of Metal Blade. And of course, you can go see Amon Amarth on tour. They're going to be going with the biggest metal tour that I can imagine. Obituary, Carcass, and Cattle Decapitation with Amon Amarth. That's mind blowing. When I saw that, I was just like, okay, so every single band here is a headliner? What's going on here? Like, this is.
It's going to be great. I mean, they're playing the Forum in LA. I think they're going to actually sell out, which is going to be a huge moment for, you know, the death metal scene.
Metal selling out the Forum.
Yeah, it's insane.
So sick. So my last question for you, Brian, we ask everyone, pick a scar on your body. Show us if you can, but at least tell us the story of how you got the scar.
I don't have a whole lot of scars. I'm trying to think what's the best if I still have it. I don't think I still really have it as much. Like I said, I don't really have a lot of scars. I have a lot of tendon damage, but I can't really show you that.
Okay. Okay.
I'm trying to think. I'll tell you. So I'll tell you, it doesn't really involve a scar, but it does involve tendon damage. So I'll tell you that. It's kind of a dumb story. So I played baseball from 5 to 18.
Okay.
And, you know, stopped playing, obviously. I was good, but not good enough to really do anything with it. So, but it was fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, we started a Metal Blade baseball team.
Okay.
So we were out practicing one day, and these other guys were practicing. Said, hey, you guys want to do a pickup game? We're like, yeah, sure. We got nothing to do. So we're playing this pickup game. It's a pickup game. It's just fun. So I'm playing third base. There's a guy on first. So the guy, you know, hits the ball into left field for a single. The guy's running around the base. So I think they're probably going to be a play at third base. So, you know, I'm ready for it. And, you know, and the guy thinks it's the game 7 of the World Series. He dives head first into the base, right into my knee, and hyperextended my knee.
Jesus.
Badly. But the thing was, I was supposed to go to Europe the next day. So I didn't go to the hospital or anything. You know, it kind of felt okay. I just put a gigantic brace on it and went to Europe for 2 weeks and got through it. So it hasn't really bothered me too much, but every once in a while it'll get really painful and I'll think about that idiot.
Bro, this is a pickup game.
Like Pete Rose in the World Series or something. What are you doing?
But brutal.
That's the best thing, because otherwise I don't really have a lot of fun scars, unfortunately.
When I interviewed Phil Anselmo, he goes, I don't have any scars, but I have a tattoo that says unscarred.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Dude, Brian Slagle from Metal Blade Records, thank you so much for taking the time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Support Metal Blade Records, and congratulations again on 40 years.
Thanks so much. And thanks to everybody out there for helping us get to 40.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.